This is the No Dharma Podcast. I'm Brian Hogan, and tonight I'm joined by Todd Gardner, co-founder of TrackJS and Request Metrics. Thank you very much for taking time out of your evening, Todd.
Thanks so much for having me, Brian.
We have made a few podcasts in the past, but for people who haven't heard those, can you tell me a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, I think this is the third time you've been gracious enough to have me on your show.
Thank you.
So I am a developer of many hats and a entrepreneur. I have written software in a number of different languages, in C Sharp and Python and JavaScript. And for the last 8 years or so, I've been running my own businesses, first founding a company called TrackJS, which is a JavaScript error monitoring tool. You add it to a page and we tell you when your end user has a problem on your page. So it tells you when that bug creeped through all your testing suites and showed up in production from a browser that you didn't support or an extension that is breaking your page. And then more recently, we've launched a second product called Request Metrics, which is web performance monitoring. We'll show you how fast your pages and API endpoints are for real users.
Are those tools easy to add into your website?
Yeah, both of them have basically the same pattern. There is a small JavaScript agent that you include on your page. You can pull it from us by just copy and pasting one line of a script tag into the head of your page, which will pull down a piece of JavaScript that figures out how to instrument the browser and grab the information that's needed. Send it all back to our API where we analyze it, deduplicate it, crunch it down into what's important, and send you interesting reports and alerts based on what's happening.
The podcast we made in the past was episode 22 about TrackJS, and we talked quite a bit about how it's used and how to implement it. And then the second one was episode 94, where we talked about building your brand. So if people are interested in those, they can easily go back and listen to them. But tonight, we are going to talk about what I'm going to title The Importance of JavaScript.
Mm.
Can you start off with, let's say, why is it so important?
JavaScript at its core is really, really important because the largest and most important application platform that has ever existed can only be written in JavaScript. And I'm talking about the web. If you want to build a web application that does something interesting, responds to a button click, draws new content on the page, does anything beyond showing static text and images on a page, you need to write JavaScript in order to do that. You can learn how to write higher level languages that might compile to JavaScript, but ultimately, JavaScript is the only language that the browser is going to run. And so that's why it's so important and so popular. And that popularity, on writing and needing to understand JavaScript has leapt from that browser constraint, which is its core, into the ability to write it elsewhere so that you can reuse that application code that you wrote for the web onto the server with something like Node.js or into an embedded product like Bots.js or that sort of thing.
We will get into the back end a little more shortly, but when you say JavaScript's the only thing that runs, what about things like TypeScript or ECMAScript that people might have heard of?
Well, so ECMAScript is the official name of JavaScript. JavaScript is technically not what it's called. It's just, common nomenclature that we all use. The term JavaScript is actually a trademark of the Oracle Corporation. And at one time, they are going to come through and just like smash us all down for using that term. So the technical, official, real name of JavaScript is ECMAScript, E-C-M-A script. But nobody calls it that, really. Everybody calls it JavaScript. It's just, it's like you call tissues Kleenex. It's just that's what they are. Like, nobody calls it anything else than that.
And where does TypeScript come in then?
Other languages like TypeScript and CoffeeScript and that sort of thing are languages that are attempting to improve JavaScript. They're trying to add something new, some new syntax, some new protections, some new capability that the core of JavaScript simply cannot do. But the browser can't natively run those. You can't just dump a CoffeeScript file or a TypeScript file into your browser's console and let it run. It's going to break at whatever point you're actually doing the TypeScript part that the core language doesn't support. And so you need these intermediary step called transpilers. This is what like the ts.exe part of TypeScript is it takes that TypeScript that you wrote and mangles it, transforms it into native JavaScript that can be interpreted by the browser, but still enforces a lot of the checks and concepts that you were trying to put in with your types.
Does the cost of that extra work, does it have a net benefit?
Sometimes. I mean, like everything in software, it depends. There are times when I write TypeScript and I see the value in having types, having that compilation time checking to make sure that I'm always sending the right, you know, structure through to when I'm calling a function. But there's overhead. There's overhead that comes with it. And so if it's a, you know, a simple app, a throwaway app, it's something that like, you know, I just need to get this thing in the browser. I'm just trying to automate this one little thing. Then the overhead is too much. It depends on you and what you want to do. Anytime you bring a tool into your ecosystem on the web, because the web kind of thrashes so fast in what technologies are hot and what works well, if you're bringing stuff in and then you're not going to maintain it for a long time, it's going to be harder to get, you know, 6-year-old TypeScript working again when you need to pick it back up and do something versus having vanilla JavaScript that will work forever.
To stick with front end for a sec, what about things like Blazor and WebAssembly? Do you see them as challenging the supremacy of JavaScript in the browser side?
I don't know if it's challenging is the right word, but it's attempting to take it farther. So there are some restrictions on what the web platform can do in terms of speed and interactivity and integrations and that sort of thing, that the use of JavaScript is limiting. So with simply how fast you can interpret, you know, the breadth of what you can do in JavaScript is too slow for these really ambitious web applications that people want to do. Think like running Quake in the browser, or running Windows 95 in the browser, or running Chrome inside of Chrome in the browser. These things are just too much. They're too ambitious for what JavaScript as a language can do, which is where these other things like WASM come in, is that it's a, you know, it's a drilled down subset of what JavaScript can do that runs really, really fast. It is really meant to be an assembly language of the web so that you can write more ambitious code in higher level languages like C or in C# in the case of Blazor that can compile down and run in the browser. Now, there's a lot of overhead to pull that off. And so it doesn't make sense to use that for every kind of application. I never see a case where every web application is using these tools. But the really, you know, highly interactive, ambitious ones could totally benefit from the performance and the reduced constraints of breaking out of that JavaScript boundary.
Yeah, so it's a totally different track for a different purpose. Gotcha.
But I don't see people, you know, shimming in Blazor to pull up a calendar picker. Like that's, I mean, it's just too much. You don't need it for that.
Do you think the WebAssembly, I mean, we've had attempts at this in the past with things like Silverlight or maybe Flash. Do you think WebAssembly has more legs than those ones?
I think it does. And I think WebAssembly has more legs because both Silverlight and Flash were very vendor specific. Like Microsoft developers wrote Silverlight, and Flash probably had more, definitely had a bigger set of adoption, but it was still vendor specific. It was controlled by a very small number of people. And there were tons of ongoing security concerns with Flash and its integrations, because it was essentially like another application platform that the browser would just delegate to and say, hey, you have control of this part of the window. Go ahead and do things in user space, and hopefully you don't destroy things. WebAssembly is different because it is in the browser itself. It is not some other program that we are delegating to. It is a standard for the web browsers themselves to support the ability to run this other kind of code within the context of a web page. And so we're able to move forward as an industry to look at getting past security concerns, being broadly compatible so that multiple projects can take advantage of WebAssembly, not just one. Blazor is Microsoft's first foray into, you know, adding a WebAssembly framework, but it probably won't be the last.
Let's switch our focus from, let's say, the front end, the traditional location of JavaScript, to the other uses. So you mentioned, obviously, back end, but I think you mentioned devices and IoT. Can you kind of give me a little rundown of where it's in use, and then maybe we'll dive into a few of them?
Sure. Well, so the biggest one after browsers is, like you said, running on the server. So we can take that code that we use to generate the client-side bits of code, or the rendering of the client-side web page, and we can reuse those same bits of code on the server, maybe to pre-generate the HTML or do the same sort of business calculation or whatever it is we were doing. But the popularity of JavaScript as a language has jumped beyond just these two sides. And programming is in a lot of different domains, including IoT, where we're trying to, you know, add more and more smarts to the devices in our lives. And the core of these devices is usually a very simple computer. And in many cases, it can't support anything other than basic, you know, C commands or basic assembly language on its own. But a number of the vendors here recognize that JavaScript as a programming language is just so universally understood by so many developers that they can build tools so that the developer can write JavaScript, and they'll handle the compilation of that JavaScript code down into what their native device can understand. So it's not necessarily that that smart bulb can natively understand JavaScript. It's that the tools to program it support such a way that I can program JavaScript as the developer, and it will run as I expect.
So they're putting their weight behind the JavaScript because it's the popularity of it. Like I've seen IBM, they make quantum computers publicly available through the cloud. You don't have to learn a quantum computing language. You learn Python, you submit the jobs, and then they're transpiled or compiled and then sent down to the devices. So that's the direction these companies have taken.
Yeah, I believe that it's mainly a marketing play for adoption, right? If I want my smart device platform to be the most adopted smart device platform, then part of that is having the most developers using my platform. And what do most developers use? JavaScript.
Let's talk a little bit about the backend uses, because I remember years ago when Node was first being talked about, a lot of people went, you're going to get spaghetti JavaScript on the backend. It's going to be a mess. You don't have the wonderful structures you have of, you know, namespaces and classes and interfaces and packages and all that. Can you tell me why I'm wrong about all those statements?
I mean, you're not wrong. There's, you know, a cycle in software where we as an industry will invent a platform to program on. And when that platform first comes out, it's wild, wild west. It's crazy. People are like, you know, just have total control of the platform. It usually runs really, really fast because it does so little. But it's full of security holes, and there's tons of people doing conflicting, you know, work, and modules are basic and buggy and all kinds of levels of quality. And so as the platform gets adopted, those problems tend to stabilize. We solve those security issues. We, you know, standardize on a set of packages, or the packages become more universally adopted and they increase their level of quality. And as this maturity happens, the platform gets slow because now it's doing all the things that it should do. It should protect against, you know, all these security exploits. It should have standardized package management. It should do these standard things. But the not doing of those things was what made it fast and cool to begin with. So now a new platform emerges that doesn't do any of the things that it's supposed to, but is way faster and it's a whole new paradigm. And in so many ways, it's JavaScript that did that, right? It's, we invented a brand new way to run it on the server. It's so fast. It's so cool. Well, some of the reasons it ran fast was due to its architecture. Others was just, hey, it doesn't actually do that much. If you're literally only responding to that HTTP request and not actually, you know, parsing any of the headers or doing any of the things that are, you know, interesting and protecting on it, well, you can do that really, really fast compared to a platform that has all these safeguards already built into it.
One of the advantages, though, I've noticed with using Node as a backend tool is its ability to work with JSON. We were chatting earlier. I'm doing some work with Elasticsearch. I want to generate an index. I want to seed it with a lot of data. Doing something similar with C# and .NET is significantly more complicated because it's hard to produce JSON. And it's surprisingly hard to produce JSON with C# other than generate the class structure that you want and then serialize it, which I didn't want to do because, you know, to go off on a slight tangent, if you're familiar with the querying language of Elasticsearch, it is significantly nested and complicated. And writing it in plain text is easy, but generating the structures would be more difficult. So I have enjoyed that advantage. I have lost track of what my point was.
The one of the things that Node is really, really good at is parsing JSON.
Yes,
and
you're
absolutely right. This is the killer use case for running Node in a production backend server. It's that, hey, I need to be like this front door to my API. And I need to get a bunch of random JSON payloads in that might be specific to this page or this use case. And I need to mangle them in this way and then forward them on to some other, maybe more rigid backend business service that will actually perform the action. But I have this cool front, like middleware layer that can mangle JSON together really, really fast and efficient. And I don't have to worry about those pesky things like security and that sort of stuff. Because I'm just delegating it through to the other APIs that will handle that for me.
Yeah.
And that has always been one of the really great use cases of Node middleware applications.
Yeah, and that APIs have become the bread and butter of what we do, calling them, getting responses back from them. And typically, we are transferring all this data in JSON. So then, you know, that speed and ease with which we can take the strings and turn them into objects becomes very important, as opposed to a much weightier process of doing it. I chatted with some people from Microsoft about this a while back. And, you know, string 20 years ago felt like, yeah, strings are kind of important, but they're not really the future. We're all going to go to binary transmission of data. But, of course, that's not what happened.
No, it is not. Rather than going to, you know, highly efficient binary streams of data, we went to more developer debug friendly string-based transfer of data that you can look at as it moves from service to service and, you know, rationally understand more of what's going on. Our services, our systems just got dramatically more complex. And if that ability to like watch what's being passed from the client side to the server side or from service A to service B, and not, you know, have to decode the binary string that's passing through, has a lot of value into understanding our systems and being able to build them quickly and efficiently.
What would you say to someone about the importance of learning JavaScript as a developer?
Oh, JavaScript. Why should you learn JavaScript? JavaScript is so universally used in examples and the foundation of so much of what other technologies use on the web that not understanding JavaScript will be a barrier to your knowledge and usefulness if you're going to work on the web. If you're not working on the web, if you're building like embedded systems for something, then yeah, fine. You don't need it. You'll better spend your time, you know, learning about pointer arithmetic and stuff like that. But if you're going to build for the web, even if you are using like C Sharp or Java or Python, a lot of that stuff is going to like actually generate JavaScript, or you're going to benefit from being able to like sprinkle a little JavaScript into your application to add that interactive, you know, client experience that'll really make your application shine. And so understanding that world is going to give you a better understanding of the platform that you're building on.
And then if, let's say, you've convinced me I should learn JavaScript, should I learn JavaScript, jQuery, Node, React, Angular, some other thing I haven't heard of, the one that's coming out tomorrow?
I mean, I don't know how to answer that for you, because it depends on what you want to do. Like, if you're wanting to learn it because you're trying to become a software developer, you're making a career jump, or you're entering your career for the first time and you just want to get started, then yeah, pick a framework that helps you build a web application and use that as your jumping off point to learning the world. Like, don't try and boil the ocean and learn everything all at once. Go and, you know, start with a React getting started app and learn how to build that. But then when you're done, go and learn more, because the universe of how to build things on the web is huge and diverse, and people approach the problem in so many different ways that sometimes it's useful to look at a problem from just a little bit different angle. And that's what so many of the frameworks that are in existence today are, is that they're not that they're, you know, better or worse, or, you know, this one's just, you know, totally replaced that one. It's that they all prioritize something a little bit different in the web experience. And so understanding multiple approaches and multiple frameworks is just going to give you more tools to approach the problems that you're going to face as a web developer.
Some months back, you'll notice, I canvassed quite a few people I know from the podcast and various events. You know, what language would you learn if you were going to learn something? And I got back quite a few different answers, but I converged on JavaScript. And you in particular had said plain JavaScript. And that was great advice. I have tried in the past to learn plain JavaScript and failed miserably. But this time I gave it another go. And I found a Pluralsight course that clicked with me. And not that the other ones weren't good. It was just that this one somehow appealed to me, and I made my way through it, and I came out the other side and went, ooh, I get it. And now I'm making my way on to Node. And that's its own challenge as well. But it was, I think, the approach of learning the basics of JavaScript was very important to get started for me.
Yeah. And I agree with that. Like, if you are like a C-sharp developer, and you've been, you know, using like web controls and the ability, you know, using all the Microsoft helpers that generate JavaScript for you, but don't actually know the JavaScript yourself, learning that language and seeing how it's getting applied automatically by those other frameworks is going to be hugely valuable for you to understand those building blocks and build your own. Because in a lot of cases, those auto-generated bits of scripts coming from, you know, big web libraries are kind of crap. And they just do a bunch of stuff that I don't know why you would do that. It's solving too many use cases at once. But if you can code that JavaScript yourself, you can solve your specific problem often in a better, more efficient way.
And I found, and not even necessarily web stuff, but I had a task relatively recently where I needed to work with public-private key pairs, generate JOTs or JWTs, and verify them. And it was relatively simple to create a little tool using Node to check my JOT against my public key and say it was valid or not. But also then it was simple to share it, because it was a five-line program. I could pretty much paste it to people and off they'd go and use it. That wouldn't have been as easy with a more established language.
Part of the the benefit there of JavaScript is that it is a scripting language, and it's not inherently needing to be compiled down into something else. It ditches a lot of the ceremony that exists in languages like C Sharp and Java that, yeah, you don't need namespaces. You don't need to have classes. You don't need to do any of this stuff. You could just like whip up the lines of, you know, the 5 lines of code that you actually need to do right at the root of the file. And for most things, that works fine.
So let's talk a little bit about nodes. Node is JavaScript, or Node is an extension to JavaScript? How would you say?
Node is a runtime implementation of ECMAScript meant to run on the servers or runs outside of a browser. I mean, it doesn't necessarily need to be run on a server. It could run on a desktop. It runs at its core inside of many desktop apps that you're probably using. Electron apps often have Node in its core. And so it's an implementation of those JavaScript rules or the JavaScript syntax in its own kind of execution environment. So sometimes Node is ahead of the browsers. Sometimes the browsers are ahead of Node, but they're all working off of the same spec.
Is there a competitor to Node? Like, is there another thing that is that runtime environment that can do that execution that is not Node?
There are. Like, there's been a number of other implementations of it. Very few have ever gained enough popularity to be serious, though. The one that a lot of people are talking about now is Deno, which is just the string Node sorted, and it's by the same guy that created Node originally, and it's meant to solve some of the issues with Node, namely around package management. Node is long, notorious for the ridiculousness that is the Node modules directory and how that all works. And one of the things that Deno is trying to fix is having a better approach, a more consistent approach to dependent modules.
So when you say
it's still very early, and not a whole lot of people run Deno in production yet.
So when you say the ridiculousness, so I created some relatively small Node applications. I add the dependency to, let's say, casual or some HTTP requesting, and then I end up with a Node modules directory with 50 things in it. Is that what you're referring to?
That's what I'm referring to. So here's an example of that. So you create a package, and you take one dependency as part of that. Well, you're not only taking that dependency, you're taking the dependencies of that dependency and the dependencies of the dependency of the dependencies, and all the way down until everything that everybody has referenced is all pulled down. And this ends up with like this really complicated tree of interdependencies that are all pulled down as their own packages, and they're all cross-referencing each other. And it gets complicated because many of those dependencies don't reference exact versions of each other. They reference version ranges. So for example, my package might need, package foo, and I need version 1.2.3 or greater, but somebody else needs 1.2.4 or greater. And now we need to resolve which versions, or sometimes which multiple versions, should exist in order for this to work. What complicates that matter is that it might not necessarily be fixed. That I had a problem where I was recently doing a very small update to a project that I maintain called Remote.js, which is real-time debugging of browsers. It's a free service that we offer. And all I was doing was I wanted to update the Track.js agent from one version to the next version. That's all I was doing. I was just changing a version number and pushing it. And I did that, and the build broke. Because somewhere buried in that dependency tree, some package was outdated now. Even though I didn't touch it, I didn't change anything, now the whole thing broke because somebody decided that that version dependency was no longer okay anymore. And so I had to actually go into the nitty-gritty of the Node modules folder and you know, move things around manually to put it back into its original state in order to just republish this thing with a slightly updated version. Because I just didn't want to like solve the whole dependency tree and update half of the modules in the system at that point in time. It's not what I was trying to do.
Can you end up with a scenario where your application, let's say, has a dependency on, let's say, A and B? A and B both have a dependency on C, but for different versions of C.
I don't recall exactly how that interdependency is handled. I know that the package system will try to reconcile that. I think they'll just pick the highest version. But I'm not sure how it handles it if they have completely conflicting versions.
Yeah, no big deal. One of the things, so as I'm making my way through JavaScript and Node, one of the things that I have found difficult and I would say poorly documented is the asynchronous programming side of things. Yeah. From what I can see as a beginner in this is it looks like it's gone through maybe three or four different approaches. It has left behind a lot of detritus. Documentation and examples kind of reference each other and say, well, this is a new way of doing the old thing, but since I don't understand the old thing, it doesn't really matter. And then it's kind of, ooh, it's all coming down to, oh, now you've got async await, but that's like this other thing. But even the async await approach doesn't feel simple. So can you clear up some of the asynchronous programming stuff in Node?
I mean, I can try to explain it, but
please.
Async programming at its core is a complex thing that's kind of hard to wrap your mind around. But async is at the core of what JavaScript has always been. The original use case of JavaScript was I need to write some code that I'm going to attach to an event. And sometime in the future, when that event goes off, my code will need to run and respond to it in this way. It is at its core, me throwing my functions into the future to be run at some future time. And that's what it's always kind of meant to do for building that interactivity in the browser, for transacting data in the browser, that sort of thing. So the mechanism that started that was the callback, is I will give you a function and you choose when to call that function. I'm passing that function as a variable, as a parameter into something I want to do. And you can take that function and run it at some future point when you see that it's time to do that. So an example of that is like set timeout. I'm calling the browser and say, set a timeout that after this many milliseconds, call this function I give you. That's a core callback asynchronous function. And you can build your own, right? You can build on top of that the browser's callback nomenclature to build your own callback functions. Your functions that can take other functions, the past other functions, and call them asynchronously later down the road. Now, this led to a problem called callback hell, which you'd see bits of code that had like 20 levels of indentation where we were passing inline functions into inline functions into inline functions into inline functions all the way down. And it became very hard to kind of conceive what was happening. There was just so many levels of interaction and asynchronous behavior happening that it was very hard as a developer to reason about what was happening. And so in response to that, or in an attempt to address that problem, the concept of promises was introduced. And it was introduced as a draft standard, and it was implemented as a couple of different libraries first that weren't part of the core spec. They just implemented promises in a certain way that wasn't exactly the same as what the spec ended up being. And so there was a little bit of, head clashing there about what a promise should look like. But essentially, a promise is trying to wrap up that callback interface and standardize it to pass some additional information. So in addition to just saying, hey, here's a function, go ahead and run this later, I could say, here's a function, but I only want to run it after this thing is done and as long as it didn't error. But if it did error, I want you to do this other thing. So it allowed me to branch my pathways, my logic, based on whether or not things were running, you know, in the good use case or in the exceptional use case. And so that's what promises introduced. That's what the concept of, like, when you see code that's like, dot then do this function, dot then do this function, dot catch do that. That's the promise interface. That is, you can chain these functions together in such a way that they can run either serially or, you know, parallelly. I put parallel in air quotes because nothing is really parallel in the browser. Oh, so the chain of thens is the promise interface showing itself. And that actually was fairly successful, and a lot of major libraries and frameworks really adopted promises, and you'll still see them in use all over the web today. It is the primary thing that still is happening in browser-based JavaScript, our promise-based asynchronous calls. In the very bleeding edge, as in what's been happening in the last 1 to 2 years, is the async await nomenclature, which is coming into JavaScript. It's, you know, also used in a number of other languages. So there is this developer utility of having the same kind of paradigm in JavaScript that exists elsewhere. And so rather than purely chaining functions together with then clauses, which is not really adding to the language at all, it's just kind of using some functional sugar to, like, do the same thing, we're introducing two new keywords to describe this asynchronous behavior. We're using async to describe the behavior of a function, as in this function itself has downward asynchronous behaviors that won't execute all at once, and await to define when are these asynchronous behaviors worth waiting for. When are we going to sit here and block and wait for this thing to be done versus just let this thing rip and let everything execute in parallel sometime down the road? Async await is not universally well adopted yet. Not every version of Node supports it, right? Because it came out fairly recently. So if you're still locked on an older version of Node, or if the platform you're working with is locked to an older version of Node, you don't get it. I'm not entirely sure. I think it might be 12. Node 12 is when async await landed, but I'm not entirely sure about that. You'd have to check the changelog. But so that's why you might see some conflicting support for it, and definitely weird documentation on it, because not every platform will support it the same way.
Yeah, I found the variations within them quite difficult. So, like, even within promises, it felt like there were maybe four different ways to create or execute a promise. And then there was the promiseify. And finally, when I got to the async await, it felt the most familiar and maybe easiest to use. But that's because I'm quite familiar with C# async await.
Right. And that's entirely by design, right? The async await is meant to feel familiar to other ecosystems so that you don't see this crazy nested callback. You don't have this friction with promises, which are concepts that might not exist the same way in other ecosystems.
To take us out of the kind of the weeds of asynchronous, sometimes when I talk to fellow C# developers, they think JavaScript, Node, it's all a fad.
Do people still say that in 2020?
Well, you know what? People don't say a whole lot in 2020, but in 2019 they were. 2020, I don't get to meet people, I'm afraid, but yes.
So are you asking me if JavaScript's a fad?
What would you say to people who say that? No, I'm sure you don't think it's a fad, and I don't think it's a fad, but that has been an argument in the past. That it was never going to last. It was too much of a mess, and so on.
So obviously, I don't think it's a fad. I've built my livelihood around it, both, you know, professionally as a developer, you know, spending a lot of time learning and mastering JavaScript as a language, but also through my businesses, building businesses in that ecosystem of the web of JavaScript. And so I think it is definitely not a fad. It is this engine, this open source engine that powers, as I said at the beginning, the largest programming platform that has ever existed. Like, there's a better chance that .NET as an ecosystem will collapse than JavaScript will collapse. There's far more businesses and companies and money riding on the success of the web as a platform than anything else. And so, will it get better? Absolutely. Is it going to change? Yes. It's good. It's going to get better. It's going to change. We might deprecate things. Bad parts of JavaScript might go away. We might add more things to use WebAssembly. We might, you know, decide WebAssembly doesn't work and replace it with something else. But like, this core of JavaScript as a concept, as a programming language of the web, is not going to go away. It's going to evolve and get better, but it's not going to disappear.
Let's say you've convinced a reluctant listener that JavaScript is important and they should learn it. How would you suggest they go about that?
Well, how about you share that that Pluralsight course mm-hmm. that you took yep. that was particularly effective for you? What did you use?
That was it. I've tried other courses and I've tried some books in the past, and I found them to, I guess, be a little impenetrable, if I can put those two words together. whereas this one kind of, it started off gently, gave me practical things, gave you a good example to work with, and then leveraged what I would already know. You know, again, variables, loops, conditionals. Now, it was a beginner's course, and they did, you know, they left out a lot of stuff. So I will put a link into it. I can't remember the name of the course or the author, but I will put a link into the podcast. And as I say, I'm now making my way through the Node course. And the Node course has the prerequisite of having some basic JavaScript. And I'm looking for a follow-up course on more advanced JavaScript, and I haven't found one yet on Pluralsight. I haven't had the time to look for it, but I want to kind of do the beginner course, which is done, the Node course, and I'll try to go to the advanced JavaScript course to maybe round it off. And then I'm playing with it all the time now, and I'm choosing to do small tasks with Node as opposed to, say, C#, like the Elasticsearch seeding, the JOT verification, other things like that. I want to make outbound requests to some web service. I'll do it with Node. That's how I'm going about it.
Good. Well, so in addition to that, I would say that there are a couple of great online courses. Jonathan Mills has a fantastic course on JavaScript in the Pluralsight catalog. Outside of the Pluralsight catalog, there is a website entirely devoted to training courses on the front end, on, you know, the JavaScript ways of the world, and that's called Front End Masters. And that is an excellent resource. It has a ton of different courses out there, including one by me on debugging. But tons of courses out there. One of the authors there is a gentleman named Kyle Simpson, who is a pretty academic kind of approach to it. But if you want to learn like the core fundamentals about what's in JavaScript and how it works, he has a book series called You Don't Know JS, which covers all kinds of things. I believe he releases them even open source. So like the thing or the source of the books is out on GitHub, but you can pay for a printed copy, which you should totally do if you get value from it. But you can go out there and kind of see his style through that. But I would say my favorite way to learn JavaScript and how I actually learned JavaScript is by using the tools of the web to see how the web works. Is you go to a site and you're like, ooh, that was a cool interaction, or that was a cool transition, or how did they build this? And you pop open the dev tools and you look at it. And you use the tools and try and understand how and why it works. And this doesn't work everywhere, right? You're not going to be able to go to like CNN.com or Nike or whatever, because their stuff is going to be too complicated, too minified, too, you know, whatever. But from, you know, small blogs, small, like, you know, individual people sites, often you can see the source code that they powered. Most of my sites, the sites that I maintain, even like TrackJS and requestmetrics.com, we don't even bother minifying our JavaScript. Just because we don't have very much, it doesn't add to it. And we think the value in letting people see what we write is more important than that incremental value of shaving a kilobyte off of, you know, pulling all the spaces and comments out. So go to pages that you like and see how they work.
Have you made the JavaScript for request metrics as available as the TrackJS ones?
Yeah, so requestmetrics.com, actually, I don't even think it has any JavaScript on it yet.
Oh.
Just because the page itself doesn't do very much. But when we do, it will absolutely be available in the same way. The application of request metrics. So once you actually get past our marketing site and like log in, and which you can do, you can like see a free demo of it and like play with the site. We use JavaScript there to adding interactivity and charts. We use a library called charts.js, which, you know, is fantastic at drawing that sort of thing. And then we use Preact, which is like a subset of React that runs faster for some interactivity in our controls and that sort of thing.
If I'm a big time JavaScript developer, what will request metrics do for me on my website?
So what we're trying to do with request metrics is we wanted for TrackJS, we wanted to know when our pages slowed down. Like we have a lot going on, but I wanted to know when we'd make a change to our database or when we would make a change to our structure, would this API slow down for real users, or would this page slow down for real users? And we couldn't find a good tool to actually tell us that. Like most of them were just super big. Like they wanted us to install like these really invasive agents, and we'd have to learn like these complex query languages to like build our own charts in them. And then they wanted, you know, hundreds or thousands of dollars a month to like get access to these, you know, massive monitoring tools, which seemed overkill for what we wanted. We're a real small team. We just wanted performance information. So because we didn't find any of it, we thought, well, maybe we should build this ourselves. So that's what we did. We built a very targeted web performance monitoring tool that will give, you know, simple information about the vital web performance metrics that you need to know, like how fast is your page load? What's the distribution between your fastest and your slowest users? What APIs are called from what pages, and when are things slowing down? And we do this in such a way that we can run it really, really cheap so that we can offer it to teams of all sizes for just $10 a month.
And when you say real users, are you saying if I'm, let's say I built a website, whatever.com, and I have a user in Australia and I've got a user in Dublin, and I've got your tool on my website, that code will execute on the user's browser and feed information back to me, the developer?
That is exactly right.
Okay, so that's different. One thing that's different than, like, I know there are these performance measuring tools out there where I can have, you know, give me a test of my application in Singapore, give me a test of my application in Japan, but they're still controlled by some other entity and they're not, as you use the term, real users. So that's the big thing, is I imagine.
Yeah, what you're talking about is a term called synthetic monitoring. And basically that means they have some headless version of Chrome somewhere in their, you know, data center that is, you know, probably on a major internet connection pipeline somewhere. And they will periodically load your web page and see how it runs. But that's not what the users are actually experiencing. Like there can be all kinds of performance information between those, you know, those calls. And, you know, what they're using for their headless browser in the data center that they're using is not reflective of what a real user is using on their phone or their tablet or their computer. And so by measuring real user performance, you can see how the people who are actually visiting your site are experiencing it. It's a little bit less predictable in terms of it's not just the steady number over and over and over again, but it is more actionable because this is what real people are seeing.
That's interesting. I remember a few years ago, I came across a tool. It was more of a subscription service where you could say, I know I'm having trouble in my website in Russia, but in, let's say, the French translation, some bizarre combination. Please find me someone in that country that speaks that language to run that combination. Huh. Whereas I guess in your case, you will get the information from that person who wants the French version of your site in Russia because, well, it's feeding it back to you and you don't have to go look for them.
Exactly. If that particular slice of person is visiting your site, we'll already have the information from them. It removes that hypothetical about where should you measure your performance from and shows you here's where your performance matters based on who is looking at your site.
What about privacy? Is there any personal information coming back on this?
No. So we care a lot about privacy. We don't identify the end user at all. We don't drop any cookies. And in fact, once that data comes back to us, we don't even keep the individual transactions. How we keep our costs low is by aggregating all that data together. So all I know is that, you know, 22 people hit this normalized URL in this particular minute time span and some other metadata about like counts and distribution. But there's no way I could ever trace back to this user did these 10 things.
Gotcha. Any final notes before we wrap up for the evening, Todd?
I think that's all I got, man.
Sounds good to me. Well then, Todd Gardner, thank you very much for your time this evening.
Thank you.
If you liked this episode, you might also like the other two episodes with Todd. Episode 94 on building your own brand and episode 22 on TrackJS. The opening music was a return by Nisi23 from the album 11 and 12, and the closing music was Blur by Kai Engel from the album La Zicchia.